Hi, I'm Valerie, and you're listening to The Beauty Brains. Welcome to The Beauty Brains, a show where real cosmetic chemists answer your beauty product questions and give you a unique look at the cosmetics industry. This is episode 236. I'm your host, Valerie George, and with me today is Perry Romanowski. Hi, Perry.
Hello, Valerie. Good to be here.
Great. On today's show, we're going to answer some great questions about, do allergens last through soap reactions when you're making them? What is CBD doing in my adult product? And is this DIY vitamin C recipe worth all the hype? But first, Perry, I want to tell you about a webinar that I pre-recorded today for a regulatory summit.
Oh, that sounds fun. Now, do you have to dress up to do a webinar?
I did not dress up, but I made sure my hair was done because they were recording my face to like be in the lower right window of my presentation. But I'm not a regulatory expert. I do have a lot of regulatory knowledge because at the company I work for by day, regulatory reports into me. So I do have a lot of exposure to that.
Sure.
But they chose me to speak because of my presence online. And it's pretty obvious that I have a good collaboration with marketing, given that especially we have the Beauty Brains podcast and all we do is debunk marketing myths.
Well, that's nice. Although some marketers might take a little offense at our debunking.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting because it got me thinking. I have a great relationship with our VP of marketing and it's just awesome. And I think it has a lot to do with some of the stuff I spoke about in the talk, which was the title I didn't get to choose my own title. They gave me a title. It was how to make PR and marketing your best friend and not your worst nightmare. And just really about how the claims landscape, because again, it is a regulatory summit, that the claims landscape is incredibly complex with the FDA, the FTC, and litigation. It's very hard to be a brand and make claims. And the FDA says you have to, whatever you say about your product, it kind of has to be true. And the FTC says you have to provide proof for your claims.
Yeah.
So it just got me thinking, and it actually made me a little appreciative of what a good relationship I have. And I actually asked our VP of marketing, I said, you know, what would you want to say or want me to say or even want to hear at this type of talk? And she just said, you know, you and I have a very unique relationship and I didn't have this at another company. So that made me very happy to hear. But Perry, you know, just given all that we do, I think maybe our fans think we don't like marketing departments. And for me, that's not the case. I get frustrated with marketing for sure sometimes. But we're all on the same team, you know? So how did you feel about your marketing team?
Well, I have to say that one of the things about the cosmetic industry that is a little bit frustrating for scientists is that the industry is run by marketing. Mm-hmm. It's a marketing-driven industry, whereas if you're in maybe the pharmaceutical area, it's technology-driven, or if you're in electronics, it's more technology-driven. Although those things too, as a technology in an industry matures, there's less ways to differentiate your products through technology. And when you can't differentiate that way, you can only differentiate through stories. And that's really why marketing kind of runs the beauty industry. It was always a clash between what the marketers wanted, because they wanted to do more and more, make crazier claims. And the R&D people were always the people who had to say, no, that's not really right, or you can't do that. And it kind of sucks.
Yeah.
It kind of sucks to be the group who's always like the wet blanket, like, I'd love to say that this can grow hair. It doesn't, but I'd love to say that.
Yeah, we're like the no people. Yeah,
right, right. So tough. I tried to, whenever I could, because I don't want to be that no person. I want to be like, yeah, we might be able to do this. But the reality is there isn't a lot of new technology in the beauty industry. A lot of the technologies are mature, and so there is just this natural clash between R&D and marketing. But, you know, when it comes down to it, marketing does get people to buy products. And you have to get along with your marketers or you're not going to survive very long as a scientist in the cosmetic industry.
Yeah. Well, if you're attending the IQPC webinar, you'll hear my talk about how I am able to successfully collaborate with our marketing team and know that we don't hate on marketing. We just want to make sure everyone knows the truth.
Right. Right, exactly. You don't want to mislead consumers. I know some marketers do want to do that, but but hey, they want to sell their products.
Yeah, I wonder if they learned that in school. Anyway, we haven't done a Goop segment in a while. I know a while back we would occasionally peruse their website and check a bunch of stuff.
Well, and I just saw that Goop, their Netflix special, got a season two, unfortunately.
Yeah, that was my beauty news, which we're not going to cover because I thought it would be more fun to talk about what product that I'm going to list is not on the Goop website. Actually, we could just go through and you can tell me like yes or no.
Okay. All right. It's a little quiz. Let's see.
Okay. And if you have children or young people or sensitive people listening to the show, we do talk about some adult things. So just fast forward about 45 seconds in the show. First item, pelvic clock exercise device.
That sounds like something that would be on Goop. Doesn't she have like the steamer products too?
A simple tool for lower back flexibility, hip mobility, and alignment. And I actually clicked in on this because I was like, is this what I think it is? And it's actually a ball that you put it on your lower back. It's not what I thought it was at all. Oh. And it uses a clock as a circle to help you work on hip mobility. So definitely not what I thought it was, but very cool, especially if you have tight hips. The next item, Vesper Vibrator Necklace. It is a fashionable 24 karat gold necklace and a vibrator.
I can't imagine someone's going to walk around with that, right? That's going to be a heavy necklace. Although I suppose size doesn't really matter that much, but so I've heard.
Yeah.
This can't be a real one, is it?
It's a real item. And I was like, oh, that's a cute necklace. And then I was like, wait, what? It had a very funny description. And it's only $149. You can't get a 24 karat gold necklace at Macy's for that kind of money.
Wow. Well, it might even be worth it. So their jewelry is less expensive than their beauty products. There you go.
Yeah. A necklace and a vibrator. Bet no one at work would know that. Okay. An amethyst crystal or smoky quartz crystal infused water bottle.
It does sound like something that they would have, yeah.
Yeah, bad vibes be gone, an intuition spiked water bottle. They do have that. It's only $80.
Oh, an $80 water bottle, huh? Whoa.
Yeah. Okay, lubricant with CBD.
I think we're going to be talking about that, so I'm going to say yes, they have it, huh?
They actually don't have it.
Oh, they don't, huh?
No. Yeah, I was actually really shocked. And that could be for a variety of reasons. Many credit card processors do not allow the sale of CBD items. So maybe that's why they don't. But I didn't actually check to see if they have other CBD-based items. I didn't see any that I recall, but maybe I'm wrong. So anyway, I did not see any lubricant that had CBD in it. Well. Next up, a self-cleaning water bottle.
Self-cleaning? Does that mean like you have to put it in your sink and wash it yourself?
Nope. It uses a digital UVC LED light that purifies the water every 2 hours or whenever you press the magic button.
So that sounds a little too techy for Goop.
They sell it. Oh. That's an item.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, that's fun.
That's that.
Yeah.
That's this week on the Goop website.
New on Goop.
Yeah. Anyway, well, we have a new segment, Answer Our Question. Very excited about, because last week, Perry raised a very good grammar question.
That's right. If you recall, in the opening, I said, we give you a unique look at the cosmetic industry. And then I pondered, is it supposed to be a unique or an unique? Because I've always learned that if the vowel comes after an A or an and, you use an for the vowel and A for the consonants,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
But I pondered that, and we got a few people who chimed in about what the correct answer is.
It turns out we do have grammar brains out in the world.
We do, and we appreciate those. We actually were contacted through Patreon, through Instagram, and through email. So we had a few people who knew the answer to this. Do you want to share what the answer was, Valerie?
All right, Liz from Patreon, thank you so much. Hey, I have an answer to Perry's question on A versus an on the intro of episode 235. The rule about using an before a word with a vowel applies to the sound the word starts with, not the actual letter. So since unique starts with a Y sound, you use A, not and. The interesting use case is historical. In accents where the H is silent, you use an, but if you pronounce the H, you use A. This is actually one of the more sensible rules of English.
So it'd be an historical argument, but it would be a hippo.
Correct.
There you go. Well, yeah. I'm so happy to know this now.
Yeah. We also got an email from the UK, Helen, who also provided more some phonetic information for us, but the same answer that Liz gave us. And Helen is a linguist with an interest in beauty science. So if we have any more language blunders, maybe Liz or Helen could help us out. And then I do want to thank Celeste, who wrote to us on Instagram. Celeste, I'm very sorry I accidentally hit delete instead of accept on the Instagram message. I do know how to use social media. Many of you guys may think I don't based on all of our social media blunders, but
I actually think we would have a million subscribers by now.
I just keep deleting them. Oops. Anyway, Celeste also provided a similar answer to us. So thank you to our three beauty brains, grammar nerds, for providing help with us.
And you know, that did kind of make me think, hey, this could be a new segment where we ask questions of you and you let us know.
I mean, there's like so much stuff we don't know.
I know. I've got a number of burning questions. I remember last year I had asked about it was in February. I asked about these bug bites. I got some answers there. But there's a question I've had, and I've tried to Google this. Now, these are not questions where, because of course, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to Google it and do a search. Mm-hmm. And I only will ask questions if I don't. Now, I suppose I could have looked up that grammar one, but that was just off the cuff. Here's one I thought I would just pose because I couldn't find anything on Google. And okay. You know, you ever, Valerie, you know about squirrels, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what is that? I want to know, what is that behavior called where if you walk up to a squirrel and they jump on a tree, they run behind the tree. And then if you try to walk to the other side of the tree, then they'll scurry to the front and they'll keep mm-hmm. you between the tree. And I once read that that had a name. That behavior has a certain name.
Aside from like just scared?
No, right. It's not scared. There's like a specific name for this behavior where a squirrel will stay out of eyesight when climbing up a tree.
Put something in front of you to hide behind it. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. I heard what it was one time years ago, then I forgot it, and I was looking up, and I for the life of me, I cannot find out. What is the squirrel behavior called where they go up a tree and they stay between you and the tree?
So we basically need either a zoologist, which my cousin is a zoologist, and maybe I can ask them, or we need a psychologist to answer this question.
I think a squirrel,
or maybe an animal psychologist.
A squirrel behavioralist, maybe, perhaps.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Well, how about we get to some beauty science news?
Yeah, this is the Beauty Brains after all.
What'd you see this week?
There were a few stories, but the one that caught my eye was Unilever has promised to axe petrochemicals from their entire cleaning range. I thought it was a clever little twist there, cosmetics news. Unilever is going to axe petrochemicals because Axe is one of their brands.
Yeah, that's what I thought they were going to axe at first. And I was like, oh my God, yes.
Do you know, thinking of Axe, I remember when Axe was very popular, but can you imagine them running those commercials now?
Oh, gosh. I would not fly.
Those commercials were so over the top. I think society has passed them by. Anyway, Unilever says it's going to remove petrochemicals from their cleaning ranges, and they call their strategy the Clean Future. More clean beauty marketing, yay. they are focusing on lowering their carbon footprint and reducing their waste without compromising on performance. And that is the part that I think is going to be a pretty big challenge. You know, whenever in the cosmetic industry or even the, you know, any personal care industry, whenever we can take a chemical that has a bad reputation or there's something negative about it and we can just replace it with something that works just as good, we do that like right away. I remember back in the 90s, everyone used like Loramide DEA as a secondary surfactant for shampoos because they're great secondary surfactants. But there was an issue of nitrosamines and cancer. Overnight, the industry just said, oh, let's get rid of that because you could easily switch it with cocoamidal propyl betaine, and so it's DEA free. So the cosmetic industry is very sensitive to bad chemicals. And if there is an easy swap out, we do it. But in a case like this, usually when a chemical persists in a formula, then it because petrochemicals have a bad reputation. When something persists, that's because there isn't a good replacement. So they say that they're going to be ending their dependence on non-replaceable fossil fuels and using renewable or recycled carbon sources instead. They are targeting a complete replacement by 2030, a mere 10 years ago. Now, this is an impressive sounding goal, although it just doesn't sound very realistic to me. I mean, you're going to change all your formulas within 10 years and they're going to work the same?
It's very difficult to do because, one, yes, they're choosing to use the ingredients they're using, but it also has to do with what the world is capable of producing. For example, in their Axe body spray, they use butane, propane for their propellants out of the can.
Right.
Those are produced both by natural gas production or processing and petroleum refining. So unless they have some alternative or can only use natural gas, it's very unlikely that they'll be able to make the switch. It's a very good goal, but we can only do what the infrastructure is able to do. Additionally, they have these very famous fragrances. I think everyone can recognize an Axe body fragrance. Sure. And fragrances come from synthetic compounds, natural compounds, and these synthetic compounds typically come from benzene chemistry, and benzene is a byproduct of the petroleum industry. So even just speaking of their fragrances, I would be very interested to see what they are able to do. But I don't see it happening based on what the raw material infrastructure has as a possibility. Even in the next 10 years, I would say that would be very difficult.
And the thing is, you can certainly get these things from plants. It's hard, but you can. But they're produced in plants in such tiny amounts that it just is not efficient to do that. So the costs are going to be huge. Not to mention the amount of land that it's going to take. Let's get rid of farmland and just grow ingredients for cosmetics. It just does not sound like a good idea when you're trying to feed 7 billion people.
And yes, petrochemicals have a very bad reputation and connotation, but you also have to look at what the alternative is and ask yourself if that environmental impact is any better. So it's a really tough call. As you said, kudos to them and these other companies that are coming out with sustainability initiatives like removing petrochemicals. Very difficult to do. And given the length of their pledge, I really would like to see if they're able to provide progress reports on how they're doing or if this is something that will kind of just disappear into the night.
Well, I know Unilever and P&G and all the big guys, they do produce sustainability reports every year. Unilever has said that they are trying to achieve a deforestation-free supply chain by 2023. Seems rather quick. But I suppose that's if you take a tree and plant a tree, then you're not deforesting. So that's good.
Also, how many of their products are in in paper of any kind. Most of them are probably in plastic components with vinyl labels and that kind of stuff.
Although I suppose that they, because they're talking about all their cleaning products, I suppose they're also considering like palm-derived ingredients and that sort of thing.
Well, it'd be interesting to check that out because a lot of fragrances also use palm.
Right. It's a challenge. They also are going for net carbon emissions zero by 2039.
Almost 20 years. Yeah, well, that's a 19 years. I could have a baby next year and they could finish high school by then.
You could. Wow. that's an interesting way to look at things. And then they're looking at having their use of virgin plastic packaging by 2025. Another challenge, especially since I heard this podcast about the reality about recycling plastic, and pretty much it's not really being done.
Yeah, it's awful.
Yeah. Anyway, I say kudos, like you said, to Unilever for trying this. You know, we'll see what impact it is. But, you know, it's just unlikely they're going to do the number one thing that occurs to me every time I hear these companies talking about sustainability and reducing their environmental impact. The biggest thing they could do, you know what that is, Valerie?
Stop selling products.
That's right. Just don't sell as much.
Stop
right?
creating trash, or tell have people, a yeah, producer just, responsibility program to take the trash back right. and safely but, repurpose
but,
it.
But also tell people don't use our stuff as much. You know, do we really need to shampoo our hair every single day? Do we need to shower every day? I mean, we don't really need to do that stuff. So if you want to reduce your impact on the environment, just sell less. I wonder why we never see that sell less campaign.
Yeah, although, you know, it's something to keep our eyes on, because I did see an article in GCI magazine and they said, is the future of beauty brands that only have one product? And at first I was kind of like, nah. And then I was like, yeah. And then now I'm like, nah. I mean, the whole point is you make more money once you saturate your consumer base. You need something else, right? So I don't think it'll stick. But anyway.
Yeah, interesting. Well, that was a news that caught my eye.
We have one more segment for you guys. We did find one other article on Huffington Post. And Huffington Post wants to tell you that these expensive beauty products are worth it. But why don't they let us be the judges of that?
Well, they let their the people that they let be the judge are like you know, makeup artists and people that make products, which I find interesting. But they listed nine products. Their title was nine expensive skincare products that are worth the splurge. At least beauty bloggers say so. Now, I wonder how many of these beauty bloggers are getting kickbacks from the companies for saying this, but that's just how the industry works. But here are the nine things. Now, Valerie, I haven't used any of these, at least I don't know, but perhaps you've used some. They say that the Amore Pacific Treatment Cleansing Foam, I looked at the formula. The formula was based on stearic acid, myristic acid, so it's more like a soapy product.
Yeah, very creamy, very good at removing makeup, probably, as they say. It is $50, which is a bit hefty for me. You should not be spending your money on cleansers. I have used this, and it was nice. I just don't know that it was like $50 nice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lower
price. That's a lot for a cleanser. I mean, that's like a lot.
Yeah, especially you just wash it down the drain. So there you go.
Yeah, I wouldn't buy that one. I have used it, but I wouldn't buy it.
Their next one is a Miracle Water 3-in-1 Micellar Cleanser for only $38.
Yeah, so this one I once used a sample of. And again, I just would not drop that kind of money on a cleanser, especially one that probably contains less than 1% of surfactants.
First ingredients, of course, water. Second ingredient, dipropylene glycol. So, and then glycerin is up there, and glycerides. So, you know, it's just a sort of a glycerin, a humectant solution.
Yeah. And basically, when you have this type of formula, a micellar water, and I'm putting that in air quotes, it literally, I'm not kidding, is like more than 97% water, I would say it.
Yeah.
Maybe even like 98% water. So you're really paying for the water. And if you are interested in micellar waters, I would just go for a drugstore product, like the most economic one you can find. They're using the same types of ingredients, the same probably ratios of ingredients. Yeah. I wouldn't spend my money here. And also, again, like, I didn't really like this one, but also I don't like my, I don't like my cellar waters very much.
Yeah. Again, product just rinses down. Next, they had this, M61 Power Glow Peel, a peel.
Oh my gosh.
Only $66 peel. What?
Oh my gosh. Well, listen, okay. I think it's like $66 for a pack of 10. Okay.
Okay.
It gets more expensive than that. This product is amazing. Okay.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. I've actually duplicated this one. So it is so good. It's a little tiny wipe, and it's a 1 minute, one step exfoliating facial peel with glycolic acid and salicylic acid and some extracts, but don't worry about those. They're not doing the brunt of the work. And the idea is you use this to wipe all over your face, leave it on for a minute, and then you're ready to go on with the next step in your routine. And the results from this are very good because guess what? Glycolic acid and salicylic acid are pretty daggone effective.
Sure, sure. And this delivery system is probably the most efficient way to deliver those ingredients.
Super convenient. And I personally have felt really good results from this. Everyone I know who's ever tried it is obsessed with it. Huh. I would totally recommend this product if you have the money. It is expensive, but if you're willing to invest in skincare, I totally recommend this product. You can get it at bluemercury.com. I'm not affiliated with M61 or Blue Mercury. I'm just a fan of the product.
Yeah, neither are I. When are we going to get that big beauty kickback money?
Yeah.
Sorry, folks.
I don't have an affiliate link, but it's just a great product.
Let's just go through these a little quicker. Number four is their Fresh Black Tea Firming and Depuffing Eye Cream. Come on, eye cream, who you crapping? $68. Okay. Whoa.
Way overpriced. Okay. I really did enjoy this cream, but I like to use it more as a very nice all-over moisturizer. I thought it was a bit heavy for my eye area, but I did enjoy it, and I tried it as a sample. But I wouldn't pay full price for it.
We got water, glycerin, butylene glycol, and squalane. Okay, pretty standard ingredients. If you're looking for a replacement, just look for those ingredients. Next, the SkinCeuticals Retexturizing Activator. $82 for 30 mils. What?
I do like this product.
Oh, come on.
It's just really expensive, but I'm a big fan of SkinCeuticals. It's a little pricey for me. But yeah.
And for that priciness, what do you get? Let's check their ingredients real quick. Looks like 25% hydroxyethyl urea, aminosulfonic acid, and hyaluronic acid, of course. But it looks like water, urea, okay.
The SkinCeuticals products are nice. They're just really expensive.
Pricey.
That's just my warning.
Speaking of pricey, how about SK2 facial treatment essence? Have you tried this one?
I've tried some of the SK2 products at Sephora, but it's $99. I don't care what's in it. No way.
What's in it is they don't tell you the exact ingredients. They say it's a bio ingredient derived from yeast fermentation. Okay. So a yeast ferment. Two more. Tatcha Essence Plumping Skin Softener.
Yeah, so I generally like the Tatcha products. I think they tend to be a bit over-fragranced. I personally have not tried this product. Would I try it? Yeah, I probably would. Meaning I would try it like literally at the store and get a little sample from Sephora. But I don't think that I would pay the money for it. It's $95.
Yeah, these are more yeast filtrates. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. And two. Well, here's the La Mer cream, which for $190. Yikes. I know La Mer is very popular, but.
Yeah. I've actually tried this product because I used to work for a company where they had to buy like jumbo tubs for some other thing that they were doing. And it's a very nice moisturizer. And I know the company that sells the algae-based actives for La Mer, and they have all these great studies. I don't know what concentration La Mer is using them at. I would say most of the work is coming from their petrolatum-based ingredients, and it's pretty close to Nivea in texture and feel. So you could probably find a drugstore dupe, go without the algae actives, and get very similar results.
No, when you get mineral oil, petrolatum, glycerin, this is a microcrystalline wax. This is pretty much a standard moisturizer.
Yeah.
Okay, final one. Peter Tom Roth Potent C, Vitamin C Bright and Plump Moisturizer. That's a lot. Only $68. Whoa, Peter Tom Roth.
I'm not a fan of the Peter Thomas Roth products, and I don't think this is worth that kind of money. I would rather spend my money elsewhere.
Water, propane diol, glycerin, and tetrahexyl ascorbate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna have to agree that you could probably find a less expensive product that works just as well. So there you go. That is the cosmetic chemist evaluation of whether you should spend all that money. Now I will say, whether these are worth it or not is going to really depend on what motivates you. Do you buy a product for how effective it is? Then I would say you could probably find products that are just as effective as all of these products for less money, except maybe that little clothy one. I don't know. That's a little specialized technology there. But the other piece is, do you buy a product for how it makes you feel?
Yes.
Now, if that's the case, then maybe they're worth it. I mean, if spending more money on a product makes you feel better about yourself, then that's worth it, right? I mean, my wife loves her Louis Vuitton bag or her Burberry bag or some sort of bag or like that. And I'm like, I look at it, I mean, she could just go to Target and pick up some generic purse, and I would say, you know, or a Louis Vuitton knockoff, and it's going to work the same, right?
I'm on Team Perry's wife here. I'll tell you why. They do not feel the same. Yeah, you can get a cute bag at Target. You won't have it a few months from now because it, you know, it's affordable. Probably isn't going to last very long. You can find some Target bags that last a while, but I have a Louis Vuitton bag myself. I bought it when I was in Italy, and, you know, Mr. Cosmetic Chemist was super mad. I told him LV was my initials. It was like the L and V over each other, and it spelled Val. And he was like, he bought it for like 4 seconds, but it's definitely worth it. The point is, if you like the way you make it makes you feel, go for it.
Right. And you can afford it, right?
And if you can afford it, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And I will say that I actually got the Louis Vuitton bag for my wife. So
did?
Well, she wanted it for Christmas, and I'm like, yeah, that's fine by me. I mean, if a product is going to make somebody happy, then get the product for them. I mean, I wouldn't buy it for me, but I wouldn't carry a purse either. So.
Oh,
I
gosh.
Prefer backpacks myself.
All right. Any other things before we go into beauty questions?
Just one little tiny thing. Valerie, you tipped me off to this this podcast. It's called This Podcast Will Kill You.
Oh, so good. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very, very fun show. I like to listen to it. It's about microorganisms and diseases. And I was listening to the latest one, episode 58.
Oh, gosh. You're not going to give any spoiler alerts, are you? I haven't listened to it yet.
No spoilers. I will tell you, it was about like guinea worms and fascinating. Okay. You know, I love parasite talk. But anyway, I'm listening to this, and they monetize their podcast by putting in commercials. And so that's fine. That's a strategy people use. But their podcast is very science-based, and it's very nerdy and such. But they were reading this commercial out for this brand called Each and Every. Each and Every is a natural deodorant brand, and they have their whole background produced by beauty expert, somebody had a PhD in microbiology, blah, blah, blah. That's fine. And they're reading all of the basic clean beauty claims, no sulfates, paraben-free, blah, blah, blah. And I sort of, you know, it annoys me that science people are propagating these sort of chemophobia, but I'm going to give them a pass.
Yeah, I mean, they have PhDs in molecular biology, but they can't bother to read the studies that demonstrate that these products are safe for use in cosmetics.
But I totally understand that if it's not your area of expertise, you're going to, and somebody gives you this ad copy, you're going to read it. But here is the one that really got me. And I'm listening to this, and their claim was that they say, this product has been found to provide odor protection equal to that of an antiperspirant without the aluminum.
Boo.
And this is what, like, I went right away and I'm like, hey, wait, that's an illegal claim. You can't say that. You can't do that. And then I thought about it. I heard it again. I listened again. And you can actually make this claim. Their claim is specifically it provides the odor protection equal to that of an antiperspirant. Because antiperspirants do two things. Antiperspirants are over-the-counter drugs, right? And the drug part of an antiperspirant is not the it makes you not smell. It's the it stops you from sweating, right? Mm-hmm. And the aluminum salts that are used are the things in antiperspirants that make you not sweat. And so this claim was very cleverly or insidiously written, where they are saying, okay, like an antiperspirant, this is going to reduce the odor. And deodorants and antiperspirants, as far as odor reduction goes, yeah, they could be equal. It's just, you know, you cover the odor with a fragrance or you kill the bacteria. But the comparison that was in my mind is like, oh, this deodorant works as good as an antiperspirant. And it doesn't. But now if you go to their website, they specifically say, oh, yeah, we don't stop the sweating. The sweating is good and that. But that commercial that they read on there really was off-putting to me because it made it seem like, oh, this natural deodorant works as good as an antiperspirant. They don't. They're not the same kind of product. And I really wish a science-based podcast, which I love. I love the content there.
It's our favorite podcast besides our own podcast.
Indeed. One, yeah, indeed. And I just say, hey, each and every, you know.
Well, I'm grateful we don't have to monetize our podcast, or we choose not to monetize our podcast, and it's funded by our own money and, of course, our Patreons. But I'm really glad that we don't have to worry about that. But if we did monetize and we did take ads, we would be scrupulous about who we work with and not just take anyone's money.
Exactly. But that's not to say we wouldn't take somebody's money, so just throwing it out there.
Yeah. All right, let's get to some beauty questions. Okay, so our first one is a little sensitive. So again, if you have people around that you don't want hearing about adult stuff, go ahead and either fast forward or kick them out of the room and relish in what we're about to talk about.
Yay, so, that sounds fun.
A person on Instagram, I don't have their name, alerted me to a lubricant brand. And they said this brand is launching a CBD-based lubricant, and they wanted to know if that was really necessary or helpful. Now, lubricants are a little forgotten part of our industry. We have a couple chemists that I see at SCC meetings, the Society of Cosmetic Chemists, and they work for a few companies that, have expertise in sexual adult products. And I always hear stories from the salespeople about what it's like to visit those laboratories. Very interesting. But they're a part of our industry too. So that's why I chose to answer this question on the podcast. So I visited Glissant by Dr. Karen Albert, MD, and she started this company because, let me tell you why, she's a physician at Cedars-Sinai, which is right down the street from me, specializing in female pelvic medicine, and she's often heard her patients tell her that they avoided sexual activity because of pain due to vaginal dryness. They wanted a lubricant that was natural and without hormones or harsh chemicals. But there was nothing she could recommend. She feels strongly that all women deserve to enjoy intimacy without the fear of pain, which is true. That's really great. feel like there could be some products on the market. Most lubricants do have, you know, what we'll call nasties or, you know, chemicals, just because, you know, a lubricant is a commodity product. So they don't spend a lot of money on the formulations. But in order to bring her vision to reality, she connected with one of her patients who has previously started a natural hair care line. And together with the medical and formulation background, they created Glissant Intimate Care, containing naturally curated natural and organic ingredients, which is great. Everyone deserves to start their own dream brand. Good for them. Where I got a little concerned is the fact that there's CBD and CBG in one of their products, along with flavor, sea salt and caramel. I'm not sure how natural that you know, right. flavor is. But anyway, they have this CBD and CBG intimate spray for $55, but people are raving about it. Sea salt and caramel is our go-to. So classy, TSA never gave it a thought. Someone said it smells amazing and they love to use it to shave their legs, which I think of $55 oils a bit pricey for shaving your legs, but that's fine if that's your thing. Yeah. But I wanted to know from an expert if this is a good idea. You know, one of the things that the medical doctor who started this brand said is, you know, they don't want any hormonal disruptors in it. So I asked Dr. Jen Gunter, do you know who she is?
I think she's a social media, or she's like a goes up against Goop or something. Yeah.
She's heard of her. Yeah, she's an OBGYN out of San Francisco, and she has written a book called Menopause Manifesto, which is coming out in May 2021, and she has a book called The Vagina Bible, which I'm reading, and she does go head-to-head with Goop a bit, because Goop has provided some advice that an OBGYN would definitely not recommend, and Goop has retaliated against some of her comments and even, I would say, kind of slandered or libeled her a little bit. But she just speaks the truth and she's an expert in my eyes. So I sent her a message and I said, hey, have you seen this product? Because I'm not a medical doctor and, you know, I just wanted to double check my thinking and that I think botanical extracts, which we know according to many publications can cause irritation in people. Why would you put botanical extracts in a product that comes into contact with a mucous membrane?
Sounds like a bad idea. Yeah.
And then of course we have the CBD, right? And she said she would not use it vaginally unless it has been tested, meaning the CBD has been tested vaginally. And to her knowledge, right. there are not any studies on it. She addresses CBD in the Vagina Bible, which I haven't gotten there yet.
Oh, okay.
She also says cannabis is an endocrine disruptor.
Did you get past the Adam and Eve story, though, with the apple and such?
Okay. So she says cannabis is an endocrine disruptor. And it's interesting because one of the reasons they wanted to start this line is so there's no hormonal effects, and endocrine disruptors are all about affecting the hormones.
Sure.
And she says cannabis is also associated with increased vaginal yeast colonization. So I found that was very interesting as well. The last thing a woman wants is excessive yeast in their vagina. We've talked about mass and gill a bit. And all that kind of stuff. So anyway, you don't want that. So I just thought that was really interesting. The other thing I thought was interesting that they have an FDA approved logo on their products. And
FDA approved? What?
Yeah, we've talked a bit on the Beauty Brains about cosmetics don't need FDA approval to go to market. And I thought it was interesting because I think they're stating a truth, because lubricants do require FDA approval to go to market. They're considered a medical device. Is that right, Perry?
Right. These are actually not cosmetics. Even they seem like personal care products, they're not cosmetics. They are actually classified in the U.S. as medical devices.
So what does that entail to get to market?
Well, there is a specific testing you have to do based on the FDA regulations. But if you run those tests and you demonstrate that the product is safe and it's not going to degrade condoms, then you could say it's FDA approved. That just means it's safe according to the FDA, and it's not going to break down a condom, but it doesn't mean it's like safe for long-term use or that it's even effective.
Yeah. So
often you'll see this claim thrown around on a lot of medical devices where it says it's FDA approved, and that gives the implication that the device actually works. No, it just means that the product is safe to use.
In the manner that they're using it, yeah. So in this case, there aren't necessarily safety studies by the FDA based on the CBD or CBG in the product. Or the botanical extracts, they're just saying, yeah, you could, you know, use it on your private parts and there's not going to be any readily adverse effects or condom degradation. So that's where I think they're stating a truth, but I also feel like it's a little bit misleading. And there's so much we don't know about CBD that I feel like it's a little premature to use it on a product that's meant to come in contact with your insides and a mucous membrane where there's, you know, more implications than it just being on your skin. So is CBD and CBG in a personal lubricant really necessary? No. In fact, I would probably not use it until Dr. Jen Gunter says you should.
Right. I would also recommend that you probably not use hemp bikinis either.
Oh my God. Oh, gosh. Okay, well, it's safe for everyone of all ages to be listening now.
Indeed. Our second question comes to us from Cynthia. She says, I have a quick question for you. I have done several searches and no one can answer me, so I think you can definitely help me. I recently made a soap with frying oil. My soap contains 5% of used oil filtered several times. A customer who's allergic to fish asked me if my soap contained traces of allergens because she is allergic to those. So my question is, do allergens resist the saponification of soap? I asked the same question about my sweet almond oil and peanut oil. So thank you very much. We always like to take a formulation question, right?
This is a great question, actually. Yeah.
So the way that you make soap, it's actually a chemical reaction called saponification, and that involves taking a fatty acid source. It can be coconut oil. It can be tallow. Actually, tallow used to be used a lot. And sometimes if the reaction wasn't complete enough, like a dog might go and eat soap because they smell the beef tallow from there. That used to be a problem. But, people don't really make tallow-based soaps anymore just because of animal concerns. Anyway, that saponification is the reaction with the sodium hydroxide or lye or potassium hydroxide also. But with the fatty acid, that creates soap. Now, first, I do want to mention before we answer this, though, is that neither of us are allergists. Did you get a degree? No, okay. So neither of us are.
I don't even have allergies. So, I mean.
I do not either. So the questions of whether people need to avoid products produced with known allergen, really, you should address this to an allergist. But we are chemists, and so this question about chemistry kind of falls in about chemistry and chemical reactions. As I said, the primary chemical reaction that causes soap is an oil plus that. Now, the primary chemical components that cause fish allergies and also nut allergies are proteins. In fish, there's these parvalbumins. They are the most common allergen, but other proteins that have been identified as problematic are enolases and aldolases and also fish gelatin. Those can cause reactions. Peanut allergies are actually caused by a protein, specifically the ARAH1 and the ARAH3 protein, and these are types of cupin proteins. So the bottom line is that the allergic reaction that you get from these things are not caused by the fatty acids. They're caused by proteins that are in the mixtures of these things. So when you filter an oil, that's actually not going to change the chemical composition of the liquid. It's just going to get rid of the schmutz that was left over by food, right?
Yeah. It's not going to get rid of the allergens.
Exactly. Now, since the oil is made up of the fatty acids, but the natural oils are also going to have a wide variety of other ingredients in there, specifically these proteins that cause the allergic reaction. And when you run that saponification reaction, first of all, it's not going to go to 100%. Actually, I think saponification, maybe you get 85% of the reaction happens, and so you're still going to have some percentage of the oil that you started with left around. And that's just because the molecules bump into each other, and eventually they can't find the other molecules, and so it doesn't go 100%. And the other thing is the reaction doesn't do anything to the proteins, and so the proteins will get locked up in the soap. And those proteins locked up in soap can still have an allergic reaction that's going to cause if it gets topically put onto your skin. So all this is to say that, yes, the allergens do resist the saponification reaction. And, yes, people who have allergic reactions to things like fish or peanuts should avoid using soaps made with these ingredients.
In fact, we did talk a little bit about nut allergies in episode 183, so you can go back to that episode to learn more about those. But when you're dealing with potentially allergenic materials, it's very important to disclose what you may have in there or avoid using those ingredients entirely.
Incidentally, Valerie, in that episode, did I talk about how I went an entire week where I only ate nuts?
You may have mentioned that. I don't know.
Go back in that episode, you could hear that.
And if we didn't talk about it, now you know there was only a week where he ate all nuts, which sounds something like very Perry would do.
Hey, I lost a few pounds.
Yeah. Cynthia, that's actually a great question, and I commend you on your upcycling of your cooking oils. Very interesting. I've heard some people do that with bacon as well, which may make for an interesting soap.
Indeed.
Our last question for the show is that DIY vitamin C recipe submitted to us by Belle. Did you have a chance to take a look at this recipe, Perry?
I saw the recipe, and I think the stuff that we're going to say in this segment is not only applicable to this particular recipe, but any of the DIY stuff that you find on the internet. There is some things that are perfectly fine. There's some pretty bad advice. But overall, yeah, I saw the recipe. Well, let's just talk about it a little bit.
Okay. So the recipe is water, of course. Most cosmetic formulas, aside from the anhydrous ones, start with water. And that's what you use to dissolve ascorbic acid supplements in. So you break open these L-ascorbic acid powdered supplements that you maybe would get from a vitamin store or your grocery store or even Amazon. You break those open and pop them into the water and maybe add sodium bicarbonate if, you know, you want to regulate the pH. You do need pH strips for this exercise to tell you what the pH of your product is. Most acids are only really functioning in an acid pH range. And so if your pH is too low for skin, like in the 1 or 2 range, maybe you would add a little bit of an alkalizer like sodium bicarbonate to bring it up. And then you would wrap this container up in aluminum foil and only use it for a few days, a week, maybe a couple weeks to prevent light exposure. That's what the aluminum foil is for. And you would keep it in your refrigerator. And in principle, it seems like a pretty good precautionary step. But vitamin C is famous for being unstable. It decomposes very quickly when it has come into contact with water. And this isn't something somebody at home is going to figure out on their own and outsmart the whole industry and just say, you know what, let me throw this in some water, keep it in my fridge and away from the light, and it'll be fine. The moment that ascorbic acid hits the water, it's going to start to decompose. You need stabilizers in there. In fact, even us professionals have a very hard time stabilizing ascorbic acid, even with things that are available to us. Formulators and raw material suppliers are always trying to come up with more stable forms of ascorbic acid, also known as vitamin C. So while you technically could do this recipe, I don't know that you're going to get the amount of vitamin C you put in it towards the end. I would not want to put oxidized vitamin C on my skin. I think that's a recipe for disaster. So I would stick to the products already on the market that have an advertised percent of vitamin C, like let's say 5% vitamin C, 10% vitamin C, 15% vitamin C. While they may not be ascorbic acid and they're other derivatives of vitamin C, they've been tested to maintain that level the whole duration of their shelf life. So when you get a bottle of 10%, provided you haven't opened it. A month later, it's still going to have 10% in there. So I would recommend in this case, skip the DIY and the vitamin C, and especially with ascorbic acid, and just buy something maybe like from The Ordinary, which has very affordable vitamin C solutions.
I think that's probably a good idea. You know, as we were looking at this, I was looking up, I was curious about it. Like, I know vitamin C degrades and it breaks down. And I was looking up that, like, how fast does that happen? Well, the study I found was looking at the degradation in juice and how they could, like, reduce the degradation of it. But it turns out that vitamin C in a water solution degrades pretty much 100% degraded within 8 hours.
Yikes.
So you're losing a significant amount of activity. So when you're creating these DIY things, unless you make it and then use it right away, there's no point in storing it at all because it's going to be degraded within 8 hours. Now that's at room temperature. Maybe you could, if you refrigerate it, it's going to last into the next day.
A couple more hours, but not weeks. Yeah.
So unless you're going to make this and then use it right away, you know, don't bother wrapping it up in aluminum foil and saving it because it's not going to be effective. That's just the kinetics of vitamin C degradation.
Wow. Okay. So in summary, skip that quick DIY vitamin C recipe and head to an online e-tailer. I think that was a bit redundant. I don't know if any of our grammar brains could tell us if that was redundant. But anyway, head to an online shop and check out one of the many vitamin C formulas. You want to look for something that indicates a percentage of vitamin C because that means it has been tested for that level of vitamin C for the duration of its shelf life.
I mean, it probably isn't going to provide you much more benefit than moisturizing, but that's...
We'll agree to disagree.
Indeed. I think we could agree on this being in the end of the show, though, right?
Oh, yeah. That's all we have time for. Big, big show. Thanks again, everyone, for listening.
Yeah, if you get a chance, go over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. That's going to help other people find the show, ensure we have a full docket of beauty questions to answer. And if you want to get your voice heard on The Beauty Brains and you have a question, just record it on your smartphone and then email it to thebeautybrains@gmail.com.
Also, don't forget to follow us on our various social media accounts. We promise we know how to work them. On Instagram, we're @thebeautybrains2018. On Twitter, we're @thebeautybrains. And we have a Facebook page.
And if you notice here on Beauty Brains, we do not read commercials from natural deodorant places because we don't think we can maintain our integrity and still talk about products. But the way we do try to maintain the keep the lights on here at Brains Publishing, because hosting is not exactly free, we are on Patreon. And so if you want to support the Beauty Brains, go to patreon.com/thebeautybrains and subscribe.
Thanks again for listening, everybody. And remember, be brainy about your beauty.
Thanks, everyone.
Kittens.